Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age's 100th episode. I, of course, am Andrew Gellows, and tonight we have an amazing cast of characters, first and foremost to which is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. I'm not sure if I want to be a character, but okay. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for everybody for joining us. And also with us, we have, as usual, Spencer.
Hi, everyone. We are going to have a great discussion tonight. You have a wonderful panel assembled. Panel? Man, that sounds so formal. Ha! But also with us tonight, we have Carrie.
Hi, everybody. I'm excited to be here tonight. With us as well is Daniel.
Thanks, Carrie. I'm really excited to be here for the 100th episode. I'm looking forward to our conversation. And let me turn it back to Andrew to introduce the first of our special guests tonight.
Thanks, Daniel. We have two very special guests with us tonight. The first is the Tamerlan of Theory Land, Matt Hatch.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you, as always. We always have a good time when you come on the show. And also with us is another special guest, Jennifer Lan of Dragonmount and also JordanCon.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
Great. We're glad to have you here again. We always have fun when you're here.
Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Thank you both for joining us. We've had you both on the podcast many times, and it's always great to have you back to join in our discussions. And tonight we're going to be talking about something that we recorded an episode of it a while ago. I don't know what we're going to do with that in light of new information that we got in Towers of Midnight. Tonight we are going to do an episode focusing on Talarin Onryad, what we've learned about it in Towers of Midnight. Well, not just what we've learned about it, but also what we know about it. So we're going to be discussing the dream world. Kind of specifically, one of the things that brought this on is from, first off, we need to...
Good news, everyone! There's spoilers!
many spoilers.
Yeah, just throw that out there. We need people to realize that we're obviously talking, as we are, about Towers of Midnight. We're going to be talking about every book in the series, including the prequel, probably the big white book, might come up, hopefully, maybe, sometimes, as long as we aren't talking about the art.
Yep, we've even been known to cross over and spoil other series, but we will try not to do that, or at least to give warning if we do.
To start us off, in Towers of Midnight, most of the Perrin point of views that weren't dealing with his leadership issues were dealing with him learning to master Talarin Onryad, even to the point where he could stop a weaving that had been thrown at him. In fact, it was Balefire. He could just stop it because it didn't exist. Then he used his super uber Talarin Onryad powers to defeat Slayer in the end. And so we want to start our discussion there is the new things that we've learned about Talarin Onryad from the
Perrin. All right, first of all, wait a second. It's Talarin Onryad. I have to stop
doing
it.
Fine, say it, Talarin Onryad. However you want
Thank
to say
you.
It.
Sorry.
However you first read it, and I first read it, Talarin Onryad. And I know it's wrong. I still say it wrong every time.
That's why I just refer to it as. The dream world. It makes it much easier.
Yeah, there you go. The world of dreams.
Yeah. The world of dreams.
World of dreams. Or TAR.
Or TAR. Yeah, TAR.
Actually, I do have a. Yeah. Here's sort of an opening question, right? How is it that the dream world and the wolf world, you know, are the same? And you know, what does that say about the place of the wolves, given that Perrin is learning this mastery of this space from, I forget his name. What's the name of his old wolf
Hopper.
Friend?
Hopper.
Right, from Hopper. Thank you. So what does it say that the wolves exist within the dream world itself?
Well, I'm going to turn this over to Matt a little bit, too, because he's sort of, you too, Jennifer, because that's one of his areas of expertise is the world of dreams. So we're looking forward to some insights from you on that. So I'm sorry, go ahead, Jennifer. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. I thought it was made pretty clear in the book, especially in The Fires of Heaven, when they're in the circus, that wild animals appear in Teleron Riyadh, but domesticated don't. And so the wolves are definitely wild animals. So it's always been established that animals have a reflection in Teleron Riyadh if they're wild animals, not domesticated. I don't know what that says about the process of domestication, but that there's something in a wild, untamed animal that touches the world of dreams.
Well, and Moraine mentioned, too, the first time that Perrin went to her about the wolf dream. Well, he didn't know it was really the wolf dream then, but he was trying to find out about it and what was going on with him. She even mentioned that dreamers had reported seeing wolves and other animals and had often found guides, you know, which is has a distinctly Native American flavor to me, you know, the spirit guides and the familiar.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So Hopper even sort of has a Native American sort of feel to the way he talks.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I like that it was brought up so early in the book. I mean, it is, as Baron said, the third constant across all worlds. So to me, it means that, you know, all the worlds, all the souls of all the worlds, they're all connected in this place, in essence. I mean, obviously, everyone doesn't go to the same world of dreams, you know, depending on what world they're on. But at the same time, they're all interconnected. And so there's kind of, I think we saw so much of in Towers of Midnight, which was nice, when Perrin had that moment where he sees Rand going through his, you know, whatever you want to call that, the battle, the reintegration that he was going through, and seeing that it was something the wolves were aware of and also almost something they anticipated and knew was coming, and that it was kind of playing in both worlds, or in essence, in all worlds, to me was really, it really kind of put the world of dreams, which kind of seemed kind of this place where Egwene and some people played around a lot, it raised its importance up, or its, you know, importance as a subject that we should try to understand as we read the book, which I really liked about Towers of Midnight.
Yeah, I've always felt that.
Go ahead.
Sorry, talking over you. I always felt like the world of dreams was going to play a major role somehow in the last battle. That they didn't introduce this as just like, okay, here's a cool way for you to talk to each other long distance. But this is something that's important, and there's a reason why so many characters have access to it. There's a reason why Forsaken lay claim to territory there. It's always felt to me like the world of dreams is something very important.
Yeah, you add in the Heroes of the Horn, and add in kind of the concept of the soul pool and these special souls actually kind of residing. You know, whether or not they reside in that one specific world of dreams, or if there's some special layer, because it does seem like they can hide themselves, you know, away from being found, whereas it's not as easily done.
Well, they might just have just the perfect master of the world of dreams when they're dead, that they don't, you can't see them unless they want to be seen, kind of like ninjas.
Exactly. Yeah, that
there could be like five of them in the room right now.
What I like about that is he hasn't told us everything. He's given us so much information about the world of dreams, but even for a question like that, it's still kind of left out there for us to kind of imagine exactly, you know, some people want to imagine ninjas, you know, and other people want to imagine, you know, the multiverse or, you know, or string theory or whatever. Like, that there's many layers to this world that maybe we haven't even discovered as leaders because he hasn't shown them to us.
Well, I think you touched on something that I think is possibly going to be really important, and that was Varen's quote way back when, which I believe was repeated in Towers of Midnight, that there was a third constant beside the Creator and the Dark One, and Teleronrad was given equal weight in her comment to them. So it makes me wonder if it isn't, in a way, almost a force of its own, not necessarily an interactive force the way the Dark One and, to a lesser extent, the Creator are, but I thought that was a really interesting quote, which I had totally forgotten about.
Well, it goes back in a sense to the question that Spencer asked, which is, how is Perrin able to deflect, you know, even Balefire directed at him, right? Is this a power, or is there a power within Teleron Riyadh which actually equals not just the Dark One and Creator, but actually their powers as well? The one power, the true power.
Well, on that note, it's significant that neither Perrin nor any of the Aes Sedai, regardless of their light or dark affiliation, were actually there in the flesh. If Rand were physically in the world of dreams and threw a Balefire thing at Perrin, I'm pretty sure Perrin would be toast. because it's an actuality. Whereas even to an extent, dreaming yourself into the world of dreams, remember there was some thing very, very early on where like Egwene or Nynaeve tried to like channel fire, but because the only thing you can really channel in the world of dreams is spirit because you're sleeping. And that's the only one you can actually channel in your sleep. It was more a creation of their mind that they were actually channeling flows of fire and not actual physical weaves. So Perrin, having mastered it, just kind of goes, you know, you're just imagining that it's at me, and you know what? It's not going to hit me.
Okay, I have to disagree with that on 2 points, Andrew, because the only power that you can channel while you're asleep is spirit, but they can channel all the powers in the world of dreams. And do.
It depends on how they're there. If Egwene is there due to her ability as a dream walker, she can channel all five powers. If you're using the original Dream Tirangrial, which is the twisty one that Marin gives them, then you can channel all five powers. It's when you're using one of the Tirangrial that requires active channeling that you have to use spirit to activate it, and you can only use spirit while you're activating it.
Yeah, it's more difficult to channel when they look misty and sometimes not quite there. And the other thing was, I've forgotten my question.
I think it's a good question. I tend to err on the side of Teleronriad being able to affect its own world to a greater degree than the one power could come in. And I'm leaning towards the fact that in Teleronriad, even if someone's there physically, that their weave could still be canceled out by somebody that asserted, you know, that understood Teleronriad to the degree that Perrin feels it and understands it. I don't think there are very many that could, but I'm leaning towards that side. I don't think we have the answer, but that's right.
No.
Leaning that way, it feels to me like if you were a master of Teleronriad, that even somebody physically coming into that realm, but the realm itself, that just the sheer fact, whether or not it's, you know, that it's, you know, that it sent it somewhere else or that whatever your thoughts did with it, it might not have canceled it out. It might have done something else with it, but I'm leaning that way.
I think I
would have to agree with that. Yeah, because Mogadian said that when they were there in the flesh, they were stronger than they were if they simply came as a dreamer, in any other way. But she didn't say that their weaves their weaves were more powerful than. She said that they were stronger when they came in the flesh, but she didn't say that they were all powerful. And I do remember that Band and Robin were canceling each other's weaves out as they were fighting and running through the palace in the world of dreams.
Oh,
and I do agree with you. I believe that Perrin probably could manipulate Teleronriad to cause the weaves to just disappear the way he did in the White Tower battle.
So there's another key piece that happens that we see, which seems to be some merging of mirror Teleronriad. When we see that when Egwene meets with Elaine and Nynaeve, she notices on, I can't remember which room in the White Tower she's in, but she notices the different symbol on the wall. And I think her impression is true. I think she says something along the lines of, you know, it seems like pattern fraying. But I think what we're seeing there is the fact that there is some merging going on between other mirror world Teleronriad where that symbol would have been on the wall. If it's a symbol or if it's in the window or something like that.
Yeah, it's in the rose window in the hall of the tower.
Yeah.
Where it has the dragon thing on it as part of the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai.
I thought that was interesting. I'm going to interject here because I happen to be a stained glass person who worked in the field for 15 years. A lot of people don't know what a rose window is and they imagine the window with a picture of a rose in it. It's actually, if you look at some of the cathedrals, like I never can pronounce it properly, Chartres or Chartres in France. There are huge circular windows with geometric designs for the most part, often in sections that are divided by stone and everything, but the entire thing is circular. And they're quite impressive, really. So I think it's really cool that Glenn had that put in the White Tower to catch
the What's nice is it substantiated something that we had kind of played with for a long time, which was the belief that there did exist other, that in essence that a mirror world had its own Teleronriad. And so it didn't 100% tell us that that's what we're seeing, but it feels, I mean, it, I'm now much more confident in that theory that all the mirror worlds, which we're told all the worlds are connected by this, but that they all have their own Tar or Teleron Riyadh or their own version.
Their own reflection.
It's their own, yeah, exactly. Every mirror world has its own world of dreams reflection too. And that those are interwoven, I mean, that, you know, that they're connected, you know. So what's interesting is, you know, if the stained glass window can merge, because the pattern spraying, could somebody be accidentally taken in their dream to another, you know, to the mirror world version of Teleron Riyadh? Could they accidentally skip over or be taken, you know, or walk, you know, think they're walking through their own world version, but end up in someone else's? In other words, could Egwene end up seeing herself in Teleron Riyadh because the Egwene of that one merges or for a moment comes into the real world version of Teleron Riyadh?
Oh, that's a spooky thought.
I had a thought on that.
I'm thinking of Stargate's Quantum Mirror now, where you had to time it just right to get back to the one that you left.
Well, and I also wondered, and I was surprised we didn't see it, right? If it answered that question, Matt, about other worlds also having their own Teleron Riyadh, what about the world of the Elfin and the Elf? Is there a connection between that, between the Portal Stone world and the Dream world? I mean, there are all these other sort of mirror worlds that exist. I wondered about those connections also.
So their world is a parallel world, which I would suggest we know. Well, I'm going to say it as it's factual, but I'm happy if someone has a different opinion. But you know, I think of the real world as a parallel world too. There are other universes, other worlds like the Aelfin or the world from which the Ogier came, which are on, to me, the same level as the real world. And I believe the Aelfin world and these other worlds also have their own version, or their own mirrors. There's mirror worlds that pertain to those worlds too. But beyond that, we do know, you can't enter the world of the Aelfin in Teleron Riyadh. So there's some, I think of it as kind of what makes the most sense to me is, you know, kind of like a setting. I believe the world exists there, I just don't believe it can be entered.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Matt, because the Tower of Genji exists in the Wolf Dream, in the World of Dreams, and as far as we know, nobody's even tried, and Brigitte actually warned Karen about trying to enter the tower, not that he knew how, when she first met him outside of it. And who knows, if he'd had a bronze knife or imagined a bronze knife and opened it, maybe he could have entered through there. Why would that portal exist in Teleron Riyadh if you couldn't use it to enter the world?
There are a couple of things. The portal itself is only, in essence, to a crossroads because two worlds exist there. So when Jordan answered the question, let's see if I have it here. He answered the question about entering Aelfin. And the reason why I brought that up is he said that, so he answered a question back in 1996. The question was also, what was going on in Aelfland when Matt went round and round and round the same location? Were they traveling in time? His answer was, not traveling in time. The physical laws of nature differ. Mentioning the Dark One here is bad luck. In Aelfland, it is really bad. You cannot go to Aelfland in Teleron Riyadh. Similar to aesthetic. Mm. Is how it was. So the reason why I do agree with you that Brigitte said that you could go through the tower itself, but the question really to me is, can you get to the crossroads, but you just can't enter, you know, and then you can't get back out of the tower? So are you stuck in the Teleron Riyadh version of the crossroads and you just can't move? You know, I wonder if that's what she was saying, was you could get through here, but you're not going to be able to go much further, you know, and it would be kind of stupid because it's very difficult to get in and out of this place through here. So that's how I kind of make it all work in my mind with having this quote, but knowing that having the quotes from the books, that's how I kind of...
I mean, personally, too, given what we learn about Birgit's past in the Land of the Sands, kind of now would suggest that, I mean, she probably doesn't understand, you know, the grand metaphysical mechanics of how that section of the universe works, and that she very well could have just been warning Perrin against going into the tower, because in her mind, going into the tower is going into the Finn's world. And while the Finns took their pleasure in killing her and Geidel, you know, X number hundred of years ago, and you know, it's just one of those generals. He's going to warn everybody away from the tower regardless, because going into the tower is stupid.
You know, I'm going to deviate here from my outline a little bit, because you brought up Brigitte and that, and it made me think of something that I hadn't thought about, which was Brigitte's continually mentioning when she meets the girls in Teleronrad in the beginning that speaking to them violates the precepts and doing these other things violates the precepts. Who laid down these precepts and how does she know about them?
Yeah, that's never explained.
No. They've got to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The first hero of the horn. I don't know. You know, I have no idea.
I know. Maybe when you die and show up there, somebody, you know, one of the other heroes says, okay, here are the ground rules.
Yeah.
Well, what's never made clear is whether or not these souls existed prior to the creation of the world in which they were placed. And so we don't really have any idea beyond the fact that we know that she has her own kind of, you know, super personality where she's aware of all of her lives. And so some of the data, you know, what has she learned in the countless lives she's lived? You know, what has she learned in the countless, you know, in the time that she's spent waiting for her life, you know, from the other heroes? And obviously she has so much access to information and history as that individual we meet initially that she's almost godlike. You know, there's almost, you know, she has, obviously she might not have the power to create an entire world on her own, but she has so much information in it. So maybe the precept is somehow set by the wheel, that, you know, somehow they know intuitively what they're allowed to do or what they're not allowed to do in that state that they're in. I don't know.
Well, and it's not unreasonable to assume that all those people who have been bound to the horn and are stuck in Teleronrad, you know, between lives, that at some point in time they would have gotten together and said, okay, we need to live by this and this and this rule so that we don't affect, you know, mortality as much. I don't know. I don't know why they would do something like that, honestly. Those kind of issues that come up in any piece of fiction where you have what appear to be higher beings that have more knowledge and or power than you, the morality of those of said beings always kind of confuses me. But it's not unreasonable to assume that they would have made such a decision. My biggest question is, who enforces the precepts?
Yeah.
If they have been set down, who enforces them? What's the punishment and who enforces that?
Because nobody ever seems to come after Brigitte and say, hey, quit hanging out with those guys. She does come to a bad end, though.
Well, that's why I think it might be related to the wheel. For example, you know, the wheel needs champions, but the question is, if you break the precept, are you really that useful to the wheel because you are likely affecting it in a way that it is not anticipating or controlling? And so the question becomes, does breaking the precepts make it possible that she will no longer be a hero in her next life?
Well, and if I can follow with that, are there villains of, well, not villains of the horn, but the equivalent? Right? We've seen heroes' souls in Teleronrad. One would assume that there are villains. Now, our villains in the series are, you know, the Forsaken who...
I doubt that, because Jordan had said in interviews that the heroes of the horn are a corrective mechanism of the wheel, a way of correcting something that's gone wrong. And so I would think that you'd have to be a hero for that, because you're trying to preserve the pattern, which is something the wheel is creating. So that just seems to be a hero to me. The villains are trying to destroy the pattern.
Well, yes, but you also have to think that the wheel and the pattern strive for neutrality and balance. And you can't be balanced if there is no bad.
But there is, because the bad only exists on the outside.
But I think there's a balance there, because in this way, the wheel can spit out the heroes as they're needed, and that's a counterweight to the fact that the Dark One can transmigrate souls and bring people back from the dead and do anything he feels like doing. Whereas the creator tends to be rather involved in sort of things.
But then you're substituting the wheel for the creator, and the wheel isn't. The wheel cannot be the force of good. The wheel is a force of neutrality.
Well, if you think about it, the Dark One represents entropy, which is, you know, everything coming apart and everything being unraveled, then a force that kind of puts that back together and keeps it whole and maintained would be what would cause balance.
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
Well,
you have to consider the wheel allowed Lanfear to do what she did, and the wheel very well knew, and when I say knew, I I take Jordan's word. I know the wheel's not sentient as we consider as human beings, but he did say if you could think of the most amazing supercomputer ever, or and then times it by whatever, he said some quote along the lines and said that's in essence the wheel. So as close to sentient as I feel okay saying it, it knew in that sense that it what would happen, and it still allowed for Lanfear to do that. So the question becomes to me is that, you know, was Lanfear's soul, I don't consider, you know, a villain of the wheel or the horn or something, but it certainly put Lanfear's soul where it wanted her in such a position that she would make a choice that obviously it allowed for. And as far as I know, we're not saying she was Taveran, so I can't imagine it was any decision where the Taveran was somehow pulling on the pattern in such a way that was, you know, unpredictable. So
well, and I've always assumed that Lucerne was Taveran as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm
yeah,
just saying,
so his effect on the wheel could have, you know, made her do that.
Well, but I also wonder, right, wasn't Lanfear supposedly an expert or a master at Tularamria? Right.
Yeah.
So there's some connection that seems, you know, the fact that Tularamria is both the place of dreams and the place that heroes are stored is a really interesting hybrid. Right, I mean, so you have, in a sense, this being not just a world of possibility, but, you know, there's an inherent world of positive possibility. And that's where, you know, I'm stuck on sort of this image of what does it mean that Lanfear, you know, was the most talented, person within that space, the most talented, not just, of the Forsaken, but the most talented Aes Sedai of that.
Yeah, I think in the end, when we call them Heroes of the Horn, maybe everything they do, if we knew every single act they committed, we wouldn't consider. I mean, consider Rand for a moment. You know, his soul is a hero, right? But I wouldn't say that everything he's done we would all agree with was heroic nor worthy of, you know, praise. So when it comes to corrective mechanisms, we call them heroes because certainly they're doing the wheel's work, but maybe the connotation we're applying to them in the sense of what we think of as a hero like Superman is really the wrong way to consider it. I think they are both what you're posing as villains or heroes. I don't think they're good or bad. I think they are mechanisms. They're corrective mechanisms. Whatever correction the wheel needs, they're sent out to participate in and to get done for the wheel. So whether or not that correction is, you know, what we think of as bad or good, I think that correction is done by the wheel and uses those souls to do it.
Which actually makes a good deal of sense, considering that it's pointed out very early once they find the horn that the heroes will come for whoever blows it, be they, you know, light or dark. And that makes a bit of sense. If the heroes are a corrective mechanism and they will fight for whoever blows the horn, if it's needed to counterbalance, you know, a ridiculous amount of good, then the horn will wind up in the hands of a dark friend, and the dark friend will blow it, and therefore, boom, instant villains of the horn.
It's reminded me of Star Wars, where they're all running around looking for the chosen one who's going to bring balance to the Force, and there are, like, you know, 60,000 Jedi running around and a couple of Sith Lords, and I'm going, well, what did you think was going to happen if you're going to bring balance back?
There are so many problems.
We're good guys.
Star Wars prequels, that could be a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
So can I ask the other question that raises is obviously the Heroes of the Horn and the Horn itself are going to be a last battle issue, right? I mean, we're fairly clear that should be making a major role to play in the Memory of Light. The question I have then is, what about the dream spike? I mean, this introduction of this concept of sort of a balancing power against Tularamria was really interesting in Towers of Midnight. I don't know what people make of that and whether there's something to do with that being a balancing force against the horn in a way.
The coolest part to me about the dream spike, because I love Tularamria and what it represents in the book, has to do with its effect on traveling. To me, it suggests that traveling, gating, requires you to move through Tularamria, to utilize Tularamria to get, you know, from point A to point B, you are actually traveling through Tularamria, and you don't realize that it's connected to it because the dream spike is in Teleron Riad and it's preventing travel in the real world. But it doesn't prevent other weaves that you're doing, but specific to traveling itself, it does. And so it connects, you know, the idea of opening a space between one point and another. And as we're told, Teleron Riad is what fills the space between the worlds. So if you consider that gateway opening a space, you're actually touching Teleron Riad, which to me, that was the...
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It does. What was the other world that you were talking about, the infinite something that lies between? It's not in Teleron Riad, but it's the place where all the dreams, where Egwene goes, she sees all the dreams, like pink. It had a name for it. Is it the infinite space between
the gap of
the world or something?
The gap of that was it. Yeah, the gap of
it
was a really interesting part too, because we once tried to get Robert Jordan to, we were having lots of discussions about Teleron Riad, and we really wanted a more simple way of talking about things. And so we tried to get him to just give us terminology to say, okay, this terminology is fine. And I think we asked him one time, can we assume that the void and the gap of infinity and mirror worlds and Teleron Riad, can we just call that entire thing Teleron Riad or the unseen worlds, you know, everything? And then, because what we wanted was some way to say, okay, the unseen world, which is everything inclusive. And then we wanted to say, but Teleron Riad proper, that place where everyone goes in the dreams to meet because of stuff like the gap of infinity and the void and mirror worlds. There's so much going on that, you know, so when you say Teleron Riad, it doesn't necessarily include the gap of infinity, but the gap of infinity is where everyone's dreams are. And so Teleron Riad being the world of dreams, it presents some kind of odd, okay, so it's not Teleron Riad, but it's the gap between Teleron Riad and the world where dreams are. So.
Yeah, and that makes me think of, the moment in, Eye of the World at the end, when Rand uses what we've come to find out is skimming, but he uses it to enter that strange room that we assume is in Teleron Riad. I mean, is there any other instance where skimming leads into the world of dreams?
Sure. Well, so it depends how you...
We've seen people open traveling gateways into Teleron Riad.
Yeah, that's how Egwene got there the first time, I think, wasn't it? No, that was how she traveled the first time. She opened a gateway into Teleron Riad.
So it depends on if you believe that there's a reflection of the void. When I say void, I'm saying skimming space. So if you believe there's a reflection, which I believe we actually see that happen, the kind of the blackness that's described, we see that. It's almost like people use it as a meeting place. You know, it's outside of the purview of, it's not in the reflection of Tar Valon, it's not in the reflection of, it's just empty space that they describe. Almost where they watch people from that space, you know, you hear about that a lot, being spied on. So to me, it's somehow the skimming space does have its own reflection, is connected in the same way or in a similar way as the Goy to the world of dreams, but maybe not included in part of it. But we certainly see Rand dream himself into the ways, if I recall correctly, in Eye of the World, I thought. But so we know that the ways are reflected, and if I'm right, and the ways and the void and the simming space are kind of all in the same area, then I believe we do. But again, it kind of comes down to interpretation of information there. We don't really have any firm answers on that.
Do you think the ways actually reflected in Teleron Riad? Because we've seen spaces where the Forsaken has met, and where Hopper took Perrin there one time, and it seemed a lot like the ways.
Rand is running away from Ishmael, I believe, during one of his dreams, and he describes running down these bridges and noticing that they, you know, there's nothing above him or below him. The way he describes where he's running on these bridges and how they're formed is almost identical to what we later learned of the way.
If I can change topics just a little bit here, one thing that fascinated me in Towers of Midnight was that we saw Rand's epiphany, if you will, on Dragon Mount, his reintegration or his, you know, restoration as a human being, where he was basically remade. We saw the reflection of that in the Wolf Dream, and Perrin actually witnessed. Now, I thought that was remarkable. Was that because it was an event of such magnitude that it had a reflection in Teleron Riad of its own? Or was Rand basically overlapping the real world and the unseen world at the time that he was doing that. How were the rules, I mean, how did that show up in Telewoman? How were the rules able to observe what was happening?
There's a couple of possible.
And I don't think he entered, he didn't enter Telewoman Riyadh when he was on Dragon Mount, did he?
So you recall in The Great Hunt where Rand fights in the air. Comes projected
right,
up
above
in the air,
Falmouth.
Right,
yeah.
And we use this phrase a lot as we're discussing the books. We call them pattern level events. And I think that's how Jordan, in essence, described that event as something that could not be, you know, it wasn't like Rand jumped up in the air or was using himself to float up there, but, and it's not, you know, it was happening there somehow made real by the wheel. It was made mm-hmm. possible. The moment was made possible by the wheel for it to be seen by everyone. And so in that same way, I would say certainly there is the suggestion that what Rand was experiencing was kind of some of what was going on there was kind of a pattern level event. You know, something so huge that the wheel was making it known, making it viewable in mm-hmm. many different worlds, not just in the real world itself. And so that's how I.
That reminds me of, I'm sorry, go ahead. I thought you were done.
No, I'm done.
Okay. I have a little echo on my phone sometimes. I'm sorry. It's hard to tell. That reminds me of something that Selene said at Lanfair, that when they were in the portal stone world, the mirror world, that the passage of the horn would certainly be a great advance, you know, that it would actually be seen, you know, in that mirror world and things like that. So I think that that's probably the first or second really reference to that. You know, a pattern level event sort of happening. I love that phrase. That's great. That really describes it well.
Discussions about these worlds, they require acronyms. So it's a PLE and a GOI and all sorts of fun stuff.
The GOI. I'm not sure I can get used to that one.
There are far too many acronyms for things in the series. It almost makes it makes it as confusing to try to puzzle out message board discussions as reading the actual books to try to figure out what all the acronyms people are using really are supposed to be.
I confused everybody when I sent out this cryptic email that we were going to be discussing PAR and TOM. I was like, what?
Well, it's funny.
I actually wrote a style guide for Dragonmount a couple weeks ago because I'm sick of having to edit news articles written by other people for us that use cryptic acronyms and just trail off in the middle of sentences. I'm like, I'm not editing this stuff anymore. So I wrote a style guide.
I wondered personally what the Tar of Tom was, but, you know, that was just my own issue.
Cryptic acronyms is kind of like Theoryland's thing. We like cryptic acronyms.
I know, that's what I said. I apologize. I've been way too much time on the theory board and starting to acronymize
acronyms
everything.
Acronyms can be very helpful, especially when you're dealing with hard words to spell, like Telewoman Riyadh. But they can also be really confusing.
Well, especially if you're typing on an iPhone or something like that, acronyms are very helpful. But I have to mm-hmm. say that I've been typing so much Wheel of Time stuff lately that my iPhone spell checker has acquired Telewoman Riyadh as a word.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome. Well, what's funny is I remember there's a tape of it out there. It was the 2005 Dragon Con, and Theoryland kind of stormed it with like this huge list of questions, and then Emma
you guys were awesome.
Emma proceeded to like, you know, butt in and ask every single question in that list. Actually, you know, and it was really funny because I think Robert Jordan said, or somebody said, we have time for one more question, and Emma somehow managed to get four out before they cut her off, you know. But she asked a question about learners and sparkers because we had a huge discussion about being able to learn how to channel versus, you know, being born with a spark. And I remember sitting there going, listening to this question thinking, yeah, this is a good one. I can't wait to hear the answers. And Robert Jordan was like, excuse me, what did you just say? And she's like, learners and sparkers. She asked the question again. He said she had to explain to him what a learner and a sparker meant. You know, as she's a learner, somebody that can learn to channel versus somebody who's born to spark. He's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's great. I'm going to take this opportunity to sort of drift us back over onto another one of my questions, which was in some of the previous battles that we've seen in Telewoman Riyadh, in particular the one with Rand and Robin Anish Jamil, in Nynaeve's battle as well with Morgadian and so forth, when things were damaged in Telewoman Riyadh, pillars wiped out with Balefire or whatever, they would flicker back and forth and they would heal. Balefire made it harder for it to heal, but because of the intensity of the effect, but they did come back. But in the White Tower battle, I don't think we saw any of that, the environment coming back to what it should have been. Do you have any sort of explanation for that, or do you think possibly that was just a mistake? I just wonder if I'm missing something.
So my explanation would be that that is part of the pattern having problems, that we're starting to really see its ability kind of to even recreate it. That its ability to even recreate its own reflective world that it, you know, that, or the wheel's ability to recreate its own reflective world that it has, that it, you know, it's having a bandwidth issue at this point. You know, there's all sorts of data going missing and packets, and it doesn't know what, you know, it doesn't know how to recreate it, or, you know, that's how I view it. Just considering it allowed, I mean, if you consider the impact for a moment, it allowed in my opinion, it allowed a mirror world version of Teleron Riard to merge with the real world, which could have had, you know, amazingly terrible consequences. Like I said, if Egwene had gone, you know, gone to the world in the flesh and had somehow then been transported into the Teleron Riard of a mirror world, I think she might have a hard time getting herself back. I mean, maybe she could figure it out, but again, that type of fraying of the pattern, it's no surprise to me that there would be some type of, you know, you wouldn't see the kind of very quick and snappy, the quick and snappy pattern ended a long time ago, and it no longer has that ability. And I think we see that all over the world, so it doesn't surprise me we would see that also in Teleron Riard.
I actually had a thought about that earlier, because you see always in Teleron Riard, things that are not permanent shift around a lot. You know, you'll have a cup that's on the table and then it's on the shelf. You'll have a box full of letters and the letters are constantly changing. Mm-hmm. What if you're always shifting through different versions of Teleron Riard and you just don't realize it because the shifts are so quick? And so now you're in a version where the letter's on the table, and now you're in a version where the letter's in the box. Now you're in a version where the cup is on the shelf. And you're just moving so rapidly through all these different possibilities that you don't really notice it. You just think that things are moving around in kind of a weird way.
And if you crossed over into another reality, I mean, how would you know?
Well, it's possible. I think we would see, if that was the case, I think we would see many more instances of there being, you know, larger differences to the world. I mean, I like the concept of it. I think that very well could be the explanation for many of those effects that we do see, especially as the pattern is, I mean, the pattern has been starting to fray for the entire, I mean, for in essence, the entire series. It's, you know, it's begun since we've ever seen it. If that, I don't know that I would believe it's the natural course of things, but I certainly think that it could be a very valid explanation for what's happening now.
It was interesting that Egwene assigned almost an intelligence to the pattern when she told Nynaeve that the dragon fang appearing in the rose window was not what she had put in the window, but it was, in her words, Teleron Riard's interpretation of it. I thought that was kind of odd. I mean, she definitely assigned it, it's, you know, a certain amount of intelligence.
Well, and there's another kind of parallel concept going on in the physical world, and it just occurred to me a little bit ago. We talked about, you know, the possibility of other Teleron Riards bleeding into one another, hence, you know, this alternate rose window appearing in what we think of as our Teleron Riard. Is it then possible that when we experience events in the world, such as rooms being in totally different areas, that's not the Dark One affecting stuff and insidiously moving things so that doors don't have, or, you know, rooms don't have doors anymore or anything like that? Is it possible that for a brief moment, a different piece of a different reality just happened to shift into place in where, or in the same area that we were actually in already? So that, you know, what was once a hallway suddenly has this weird painting that would never have been in our version of the White Tower at all, suddenly it's there? Is that possibly just, you know, the pattern breaking down enough to bleed realities into each other?
Well, it's certainly doing it in the real world with these villages appearing out of nowhere and, you know, all the things that have happened, the corridors rearranging themselves in the White Tower and the Palace of the Cayman, all these different places. So if, I'm sure if it can happen in the real world, it could easily happen in Telemonrion, which is much more plastic and malleable.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm actually suggesting that we're using Telemonrion's bleeding into other Telemonrions as evidence for the reason it's happening in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's possible. Certainly, I think there's some possibility there. It becomes weird, you know, because people are seeing ghosts, you know, so maybe, again, maybe all this is just fraying of the pattern and they're seeing parts of other worlds that don't truly exist in this world, or they're seeing a window to that world, or they're seeing, you know, shades of that world or other worlds that are being merged in, other versions of the mirror world of our world. You know, as I said before, when they went to the mirror world, you know, depending on the likelihood or the probability of it, you know, it was more firm or less firm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some of these things that they're seeing are just kind of less probable worlds, and so they're getting kind of this, you know, this ghost-like effect. You know, I'm just throwing, I mean, well, I don't know if that's true, but I'm just throwing that kind of concept out there that there's, that maybe there's not the firm reality of the real world, and so that's what I've seen some of these type of effects.
Do you think that had something to do with the ripples that we experienced in the previous book? We haven't seen those again, where reality itself just rippled 3 or 4 times in a row.
So there's an interesting tweet by Brandon during his reread about, I think, I don't know if it's about this specific question, but he was talking about, I don't know how the Balefire, a theory that someone posted about a couple years back on Theoryland, had to do with Demondred and what he was, you know, what his, the Lord of Chaos and becoming Lord of Chaos and such, what did that mean? And I can't remember if I sent him the theory, the link to the theory, somebody did, and he read it and he said everyone should study that theory or something. He said something to that effect. There was a, he tweeted back like, that's, you know, that's very interesting, you know, people should be reading that. So the question becomes, you know, are some of the fraying that we're seeing related to Balefire being used indiscriminately on the pattern that we're not aware of, but we're seeing the effect of it.
Hmm. So the ripples in reality could very well have just been like a massive Bale scream.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't use Bale scream, but at the time he didn't know that term, but I think that thing that all, he suggested his username is Sporkster, and he suggested that a lot of, in essence, he put all these kind of pattern related fraying, and he connected it to this idea that it really started in earnest, you know, around book 6 and 7, that there we are starting to see much more than we ever did before, and that part of his reasoning was that Balefire, that the, in essence, that the Dark One had kind of, had kind of realized that he needed to shake things up a little bit and needed somebody to use this weapon that most of the Forsaken had just, you know, had backed away from, you know, back in the Age of Legend. It doesn't answer your question, but it was an interesting possibility.
Can I just bring us back to Dream Spikes for a second? I have a question.
Sure.
About that. Do you think, I mean, I know they were, in a sense, introduced in TOM. Do you think that we saw them in a previous instance when traveling wasn't working or wasn't working effectively? Or do you think that this is truly a new innovation? Well, not new, obviously, because I think we're told, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're told that this actually was something that existed before.
Yeah, well, we found 2 of them, they said.
Yeah, I can't think of any instances off the top of my head when traveling didn't work properly. I thought about that, and I can't think of any. I didn't really look either.
Yeah, it seems like one of those fun ones to kind of, I mean, if he did, that'd be awesome. I mean, it's one of these moments where I, just even rereading the first book now, along mm-hmm. with this reread with Brandon, just the first 10 chapters, I haven't done a full reread like this in a long time, and to see everything that's happened in the last 2 books, and then compare what we have in the first book, you kind of get a real feel like the idea that Jordan knew the end from the beginning is becoming really clear. And
that there really was a plan the whole time.
Yeah, you kind of lost that. I mean, I lost that feeling somewhere around book 9 and 10, I was like,
yeah.
Really? This is what we
envisioned? Where are we going?
But now in these last two books, you read the first book again, and it's just like, wow. You know, there's so much that, you know, even in the prologue, just rereading the prologue again, even if you've read it 5 or 10 times, mm-hmm. comparing
yeah.
it to Towers of Midnight and the Rand we meet there, you kind of get the feel of like, oh wow, we're finally coming back around to what he was talking about that he saw from the very beginning. But yeah, I'm, that's definitely something I'm going to look out for, I think, is the dream spike. I can't imagine that Ishmael or Moradin, we don't know exactly when he found them or got possession of them. I can't imagine he wouldn't have used them on his own if the occasion presented itself that he needed to, and we as the reader just didn't realize what we were reading at the time because nothing was made of it. It'd be fun to find something like that, and definitely will look for it, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head either.
Yeah, because I really, you know, would like to know if the dream spike had come up earlier, just because it would be cool to see that.
Yeah, we don't know when he found them, so it could have been easily used before.
I seem to recall, and maybe I'm my reread was slightly more recent. I actually went beginning to end of the series in anticipation of Tower of Midnight coming. And then read Tower of Midnight sort of at the logical point when I came through. But I seem to recall an incident where an Ashaman was having difficulty, doing traveling. This was before, it was either in Gathering, it must have been Gathering Storm or the book before, where there was an incident where an Ashaman could not, produce a gateway.
Well, the only time I can recall for sure was when Rand was trying to attack, the Shanshan. And several of the Ashaman were telling them that they were having trouble with a lot of their weaves, not just gateways, but gateways in particular.
Yeah, the whole campaign there
But it was other weaves as well, not just gateways.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe that's not an incident of it. Because they said in this book that all the weaves work just fine, except gateways. I'm going to try to pretend to be a moderator here again. It seems to me that all of these instances of Teleron Rad in the world of dreams and the wolf dream and everything are increasing in frequency leading up to the last book and inevitably Tormungaiden. So I have to make the leap and assume, it's not much of a leap, that Teleron Rad is going to play a big part in the last battle. And I have sort of been nurturing a crazy theory for the last year or so that Rand was going to end up taking some of the last battle into Teleron Rad to try and avoid another breaking of the world. And Perrin now becoming a master of the wolf dream really pushes me a lot farther along in that direction. It makes me wonder if he and Matt, I mean, they aren't just, I don't want to make Moraine's mistake and just figure, oh, guess what, there's two extra Tavir, and isn't that nice, you know.
There
and spare sort of thing. Yeah, we got spares. Goody, goody. these guys are going to be extremely important in their own ways. Matt, I think, you know, being the Lord of Luck, sort of, as he's styled now, and Perrin being a wolf brother, I think it's going to be incredibly important. I think with Perrin it's going to be more than him just leading an endless line of wolves that extends over the horizon to the last battle. I think he's going to be, you know, if not shoulder to shoulder with Rand fighting on the front lines, at least close to it. But I, you know, I've been wrong before in this series and probably will be again.
Well, we did spend, like we said, we spent several chapters with Perrin in this book. It like at least half of the Perrin point of view chapters in this book where he is learning Teleron Rad and how to use it and how to be more effective and all that. And mm-hmm. I can't imagine that all of that was just to help him be a better leader or get rid of Slayer and the Dream Spike. There has
yeah.
to be more to it than that, just because that's the way mm-hmm. that Robert Jordan, and really that's the way that Brandon Sanderson write.
Yeah, there has
even though
to be
Brandon
really
isn't writing
it, flailing around.
Yeah, I mean, imagine the number of chapters devoted, well, not necessarily devoted, but at least where it's brought up that Rand is flailing around with the true power.
Exactly.
True
or,
power.
You know, or wow. he's trying to figure out the one power and he's like, oh man, I wish I had somebody to teach me how to do this because I'm going to
yeah.
blow myself up.
Yeah. And
yeah,
so
cause that's like three whole books worth of Rand flailing around with one power.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I saw this theory or someone posed the idea to me, but I think the question came up whether or not part of the idea of Perrin going into the wolf dream too strongly, if eventually he could learn to somehow gate without the one power, but by virtue of the talent, move his entire body into Teleronrion. The idea, the question becoming, if he was there like that, and he was there so strongly, would he then be able to assert a greater amount of control over Teleronrion, and will he be the one that really somehow, not merges them, but uses, you know, will Perrin be that person? I mean, it feels like he's being set up to, you know, certainly Rand does not, you know, have any control or any real awareness of Teleronrion, which I've always thought was really strange. You know, I would have thought as soon as he found that place that he just wanted to know more about it, found a way in, but he didn't really do that. And so if it does come into play, it feels to me like it certainly has to be by the guy that just shut down Balefire, you know. And, you know, it certainly as far as Slayer, you know, I love that Slayer, you know, I love that Slayer did not die, that in many ways Perrin's still a little pup to Slayer, but that he certainly was competitive and almost had him. But that it almost makes you wonder, you know, how is Slayer able to, you know, enter the world without the one power, and will Perrin somehow figure out something just like that, even though the wolves seem to not like that concept and seem to kind of consider it a bad thing, like he can lose humanity and lose who he is. And I don't know if they suggest that it's evil or not, but I wonder if that we will see that in the last book, some ability of Perrin to be able to get in and out of Teleronrion.
Well, they don't have to be... And you don't have to have the one power to, you know, some of the Aiel dreamers were not channelers. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
to do so physically. I mean, Slayer moves
well, physically,
him, you know, physically, which would require either to, you know, obviously he has some abilities, some talents that's enabling that, some skill. It's never been quite clear exactly what it is that allows him to do that. But the question does become, you know, is this something Perrin will learn too? Well, that's again, I can't remember if I heard that from somebody or if it was just something I saw someone write, but anyway. It was an interesting thought.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting to me to think that, you know, these people that say, well, not only the wolves say to Perrin that coming here too strongly is bad, and the Aiel wise ones say to Egwene and to Rand, that going to the world of dreams in the flesh is bad and it destroys part of your soul. But I have to wonder how much of that is actually it will destroy part of their soul, and how much of that is just they've never seen anyone do it whose soul wasn't corrupt.
Really?
I mean, we
already destroyed.
Yeah, we think of the people that we've seen do it that aren't main characters, and all of them are forsaken or, you know, weird, twisted, half-human or two human, whatever, hybrids that the Dark One has created. I have to kind of wonder how much is that affecting the belief that coming there too strongly or in the flesh is the health of your soul.
Yeah, it's interesting. Aiel wise ones, even in Towers of Midnight, I don't feel like we've got a really good view of just how adept. I mean, we did and we didn't, you know. I like how they really considered everyone around them children still, as far as, you know, pertains to Teleronrion. I wish maybe we had gotten into a point of view from one of them, you know, or because you get this feeling like they really know a lot, not going to tell you, you know, what they know. I mean, the little they told Egwene, you're right, and I found the quote you're talking about. They said, "It is said once there were those who could enter the dream in the flesh and no longer be in this world at all. This was an evil thing, for they did evil. It must never be attempted, even if you believe it is possible for you, for each time you will lose some part of what makes you human. You must learn to enter Teleronrion when you wish, to the degree you wish." So, yeah, I mean, the question is this a cultural thing? You know, is it something that they've been taught by their, you know, they've just passed this down? Is it just something that's in the book somewhere, or something that, you know, they, one of their own maybe became evil because of it, and then they've sworn off of it since?
Or maybe, you know, it's too much power to have that kind of access to Teleronrion, and there's just too much temptation to go evil if you spend a lot of time in the flesh there.
Yeah, do you become more corruptible? Does the Dark One, and this has been posed often, that somehow Teleronrion is closer to the boar, that the Dark One, you know, has greater access, or that, for example, that Ishmael had greater access to Teleronrion even when he was trapped, than he did to the real world. And, you know, is it just because it's easier to corrupt, and it's also, like you said, there's so much power involved in the idea. Lanfear's plan, right, was to, well, in my mind, her plan was to, shut the Dark One back up and pretty much rule the entire, you know, rule all worlds using Teleronriad. But it does make you wonder, is it really an evil thing, or is it just a cultural kind of, you know, because it's happened before, they warn against it.
Or some blend of the two.
Yeah.
And rewinding just a little bit and sidetracking, back on the idea that the wise ones had this kind of air about them of superiority in the world of dreams. I would love to see a showdown just briefly between the wise one, Dreamwalkers, and Perrin.
I think they would take him. I think that they are kind of, I think they're so crafty that he hasn't even, I think they would take Slayer too. I don't think that they have understood the world as much as these women have. If you consider, this goes along, and the reason why I'm talking about this now, it goes along with a theory that I'm working on right now. If you consider what they knew was going to happen just with Avienda and who she was going to meet and what these individuals had to do or should do or were going to do, so much so that they sent a letter and that they were waiting for them to arrive, it suggests a power and an awareness and a use of Teleronriad that we have not even seen. We've seen kind of Egwene see some windows and do some interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen what I would suggest is Aiel dreamwalking. We really haven't seen them read the future. And mm-hmm. to the degree that they would know so many facts or believe so firmly that something was going to happen, that they would take these actions and that these things actually did come to pass. So
I
always get this feeling like, and that the reason why I believe this has happened is I don't think Jordan, it's kind of that whole catch-22 of really having uber powerful people. If you show too much about them, then the book loses, you know. They're like, oh yeah, all these things are going to happen. If we had lots of point of views from Aiel Wise Ones about all their dream walking and what was going to occur, I don't think it would be that interesting to read.
Well, you also have to consider that the Wise Ones have another source of information, that they see possible futures with going to the rings in the, what's the name of the city, Rudian. So it's possible that all four of those Dreamwalking Wise Ones saw the same possible future and remembered it and were able to say, okay, this is what's going to happen. This is what we need to do to cause this to happen. So, and they could have corroborated that with evidence they found in Teleronriad or by dreaming. But they also, they had another source of information.
That's true. So the only thing that would make me wonder, though, if they could have retained that information has to do with what seems to be from Avienda's viewpoint compared to Moraine's, which is mm-hmm. As the day gets further away from you, the less you really recall, and you have more of a feeling than you have exact detail recall of what you saw in the rings. And I, you know, compared to when these wise ones went through the rings to when these events actually happened, you know, I think maybe they had a sense, maybe. Certainly they would have seen it, so they would have had a sense of it. But the level of detail, I wonder if they really could have all recalled that level of detail that we get back, you know, decades later, compared to what we get from Avienda's when she's in Rudian later on. She doesn't seem to have exact recall. She seems to just kind of get a feeling. She kind of remembers something, but nothing
mm-hmm.
very specific. Whereas Moraine really, you know, has the specifics down, but that's because everything seems to happen very soon after this event, comparatively.
Well, Moraine doesn't have the specifics until that they bring that letter about Morgaith in Carrion. So they get the letter about Morgaith, and all of a sudden Moraine gets this look on her face like, oh man. And so that's when she starts writing her letters and doing everything, because she remembers at that point, I'm going to fight Lanfear and I'm possibly going to die during it. Avienda remembers, the only thing we know for sure that she remembers is that she's going to fall in love with Rand. And she seems to remember that pretty clearly because she comes out and she's just bitchy to him because she doesn't want to fall in love. And so she's just awful to him until she realizes that she can't help it and she is going to fall in love with him.
Well, and she does have another recovered memory, and it's mentioned, I don't think it's in Court of the Sun. I think it is in the previous chapter, when Avienda, it's when she finally actually gets Derudian, and
okay.
she says, there's like, it's a one or two little sentence thing about, she said something, it says something to the effect of, she didn't even remember having had that vision from her last trip here until she stepped back into the city. And it was like being back in the city suddenly clicked another memory in her head that she knew she would be coming back to Rudian to go through the things and become a wise one. It's like part of that memory she recovers when she returned to Rudian. And it's just like, I guess there are certain trigger events that will re-trigger memories from when you pass through the rings.
Uh-huh. And let you know what decision you need to make at that point.
Yeah.
I think this might be, we've sort of naturally segued into one of the next questions that I had, or topics, was all the Tarangreal that seem to make use of Teleronyad, not just the ones that allow you to enter it, but the rings and Rudian that we've just been talking about, the Tarangreal that deal with the testing to be raised to accepted, and Aes Sedai, and various other similar Tarangreal. Clearly, they're accessing some sort of alternate worlds. I presume that it's still on that, but I would welcome input on that.
I think it's constructed, well, so it's a mix, because we can't say Teleronriad exactly. There's a certain mirror world slash dream slash Teleronriad. There's like qualities of all of them built into this, some of these tools, like the testing tool, where they have, certainly mirror worlds have to come into play in any discussion about, you know, future and past probable worlds, because that's the more kind of mirror world represent. So any tool that uses or somehow creates a world in the future, to me, is tapping into a future mirror world of some sort, either to get data about it or to help create it. Obviously, the Tarangreal is, apparently, if you don't come back from the world, you don't come back out, you were stuck there. They don't really know if that person dies in that moment or they go on living there. And if they go on living there, it suggests to me that somehow there's some, you know, maybe they were sent to that mirror world and somehow they become themselves in it, if that's possible. It seems to me like that would be, that's always been the best explanation that I've come up with.
Is it possible that in some way these testing Tarangreal create a kind of vacuole? Because they got mentioned in one book, and it did mention that sometimes vacuoles would just kind of break off and float away. And it seems to me that if you utilize Teleronriad and create kind of a simulated Teleronriad within a vacuole, and then you allow the vacuole to grow quiet, you basically close it off, and the person hasn't reemerged from it, then they kind of get locked in their own little bubble of Teleronriad that just then kind of goes its merry way and person never reemerges into the physical world.
Well, the issue with tying it too close to Teleronriad is that there are people in these worlds, and so unless somehow it's generating the impression of the individual, unless somehow the Tarangreal is taking your memories, I guess you could do, I don't know how it would do it for the future. It's somehow taking your genetic code, and I can't imagine it's only Teleronriad, but certainly they're getting data from somewhere to be able to formulate this type of world where able to, you know, take from things that happen in the future, but certainly it could be. I don't see any reason why it couldn't be a vacuole, but I don't think we'll get any firm answer on that. The one thing I take from it is, you know, for example, Egwene sees Rand and he sticks around the village in one case, and we have Rand and Varen and a bunch of the others go through the portal stone, and they end up living various lives that they, you know, obviously never did live in future lives. I'm not sure how we know any exact details, but I think Rand talks about living like thousands of lives. So in that same sense, if you compare the portal stone trip that they had where they ended up living these other lives, you compare that with what happens in the testing Terran Grail, there's a lot of similarities there that tie those two together.
Yeah, well, I just on the topic of theories and such, you know, with the reread that's been going on, I have my my tweet deck, which is amazing. I love tweet deck. But I have one of my columns that's just constantly updating all the pound WOTRR tweets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Constantly updating, so I can see them all. But I don't pay attention to any one of them because most of the theories hurt my head and I can't keep up.
It's not supposed to hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I try really hard to
well, all these going back and
forth. Things that are popular or plausible.
Yeah, all these going back and forth between Luckers and Therese and Felix
mm-hmm.
and you, Matt, and, you know, just everyone. It's like, ow.
I have to quote here. I have to quote Rand here. It's not ridiculous, merely implausible.
I think Therese made some comment on Twitter jokingly to me that, you know, that sometimes we get off on tangents, that's okay. And I think I replied something like, my mind is based on the concept of a tangent. So. This is why Fairyland completely was on the docket for me. So.
Yeah. Now you went tangential.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I operate. I tell people that I work, I'm interrupt driven. So. I have to be interrupted to get things done. You know, it doesn't help.
Theoryland, home of the tangent.
Yeah, reading threads on Theoryland makes me crazy sometimes because I have a habit of reading threads backwards. I'll start with the last page and read them backwards to see how the conversation develops. And I can't do that on Theoryland because what the last page is never matches the topic title.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, what are you guys talking about? This thread's supposed to be about Asmodean. Why are you talking about Andor? What is going on here?
That is a hallmark. We take pride in it.
Oh yeah,
it's what we do.
Because I went over to Dragonmount one time and I saw somebody get yelled at for going off topic, and I was like,
okay.
Oh yeah, yeah, we're dead on it.
I don't know if I can host. One topic. That's crazy. You know.
So you're talking to the podcast tangent queen here. I'm notorious, unfortunately.
We strive hard to make it so that we don't spend any more than an hour or so, you know, about half the podcast actually talking about the topic, so.
Oh, good. Yep. So we've used up our quota for tonight.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we drive Jason crazy because we go on and on and on and go all over the place.
Here's a completely off topic. Well, it's slightly on topic because it's about Varen and some of the questions regarding Telerondria.
Okay. I was going to drag us back on topic for a moment.
Well, there are a lot of questions there that kind of remain outstanding, and I get the feeling from Team Jordan that there's going to be a significant Varen section in the encyclopedia. At least that's what I'm hoping or banking on, because there are a lot of questions they don't want to answer, but there's a lot of information about her, apparently. And mm-hmm. some of those, in my opinion, she's lying through her teeth for most of the most of the books. You know, anytime she said to Rand, we're just doing an excellent job of kind of talking around the subject, and, you know, your use of the portal stone is more recent than mine.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, mm-hmm. stuff like, I went there, you know, I visited Telerondriad once, you know, or she would say things, and you're just like, and now you think back and you're like, surely she visited more than once. And so I'd really like to, hopefully we'll get some feedback or, you know, about Telerondriad.
I would love in the encyclopedia if there were a complete character biographies of some of the more ambiguous characters like that. Like, I'd love to see a complete character biography of Varen. I'd also like to see one on Elida and Swain. The characters who are fully adult when we see them in the series. I want to know everything they've been up to. I'd love to see all of Moraine's life, all the stuff that she got up to between the Eye of the World and New Spring. I want to know that stuff. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, Cod Swain.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Cod Swain. Like, all that stuff where she gets trained by the Wilder in the wilds of Gel'dan. That's a story. I want to hear it.
Yeah.
Where did she get the Perilous Net?
Yeah, that's where she got the Perilous Net, was from the Wilder who trained her. After she got the shawl, she was wandering around as I tend to do, and ended up with this wilder who had Tiron Grial and made her earn them. And I want to know what kind of woman makes Tadpoint do anything.
Yeah. Well, there's just so much back information. I think kind of echo the sentiments of everybody, but I would love to see basically the freaking Encyclopedia Britannica just series of Wheel of Time backstory and back information. I just love to have that.
Yeah, but something so vast it can only be published electronically because we'd have to deforest an entire rainforest to print it.
Well, you know, those old encyclopedia sets that you could get where they have, you know, 50 books and each one covers a portion of a letter.
Mm-hmm.
If it was an encyclopedia set, I'm sure we'd hear people, like, bemoaning, oh my gosh, they just want more money.
The stores are trying to milk us for money.
Get book one of 30 of the Wheel of Time encyclopedias.
But it also never, like, you mean I can buy 30 encyclopedias? You mean I can just have a whole house full of Wheel of Time
30? Yeah.
If there's that much information,
there's
I would certainly
30?
Pay for
what
it.
Are you guys leaving out?
Yeah. There's only 30? What? Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know. If they went the electronic route, then they should just collect all of the notes and most of the recordings and pretty much just everything and sell it like that.
Yeah. I would love to see some of the notes, like, as an annotated version of the Wheel of Time. Like, they publish it where it's the text and then Jordan's note or Brandon's note or somebody's note saying, this is what was going on, this is what could have happened. You know, I'd love to see, like, an annotated version.
That would be cool. But, you know, just hand it out on or sell them as a terabyte jump drives that just have all the information on them. Just lock jump drives so, you know, you're not getting the stupid DVD or whatever that'll die. And you don't have to spend 5 hours downloading it. Just ship a jump drive to them. There you go.
Yeah.
Great business model.
Yeah, with PDF on it. Yeah.
Yeah, kicking and screaming back to sort of on topic.
Yeah, I really tried.
It didn't work, I'm sorry, Virginia, but I'm trying to remember.
It was a noble effort.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what all Ongriel, Turongriel, things of the power that we've seen Elaine make. Because to my recollection, we've seen her make the Adam that went around Mogheden's neck. And we've seen her make a whole bunch of Dream Turongriel. Is there others that I'm missing?
We saw her make copies of the Foxhead Medallion.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, and the Medallion, too. Yeah.
I think those are the only ones we've seen her make, though.
I seem to have something in my back of the mind that she tried to do something with the invisibility one. I could be dreaming that.
I don't know. She may have.
Should if she's smart. No. Yeah, but the Foxhead Medallions that I just thought of, they kind of debunked what I was going to say. But I'm going to say it anyway, because I thought it sounded interesting in the before, and so we can just debunk it as we go along. But it seems to me like, with the exception of the Foxhead Medallions, but the Adam that she created for Mogheden seemed to work pretty much like an Adam is supposed to work. Well, it didn't have the cord, and so there wasn't the whole tethering aspect, but it had the rest of it. And so my thought process was, well, what's the difference between the Adam and all the others she made? And the others, you know, are all supposed to interact with Telaire and Onriad. And we know that they only did that with varying degrees of success. Mm-hmm. So I had to wonder if there was something in the fact that she might be a channeler, but she's not a dreamer that was affecting that.
Couldn't
she said that some of them were just so
perfectly either. Sure.
Yeah, yeah, and when you brought up the Foxhead Medallion, like I said, that shot it out of the water. So,
take it from a tangent of your Foxhead Medallion, the question is, how is that medallion doing what it's doing? Is it somehow connected in some way to Teleronriad, and it's canceling out the effects of the One Power that are directly thrown at it, kind of like Perrin did to Egwene? However, obviously, side effects it can't stop, you know, having a rock thrown at it by the One Power, but it does cancel it out, and so it does make you wonder if there's some connection between the Foxhead Medallion and Teleronriad.
Well, it makes me wonder if there's some connection between the Foxhead Medallion and the Golem, and a couple of other things. And also Quendiar. If you channel into Quendiar, it just makes it stronger. Like, it's absorbing the one power and holding it and bringing it into its own matrices to make itself stronger. And in a way, that's kind of what the Golem is doing. It's sort of absorbing the one power, and then that's why the Foxhead Terrangleel can harm it, because it's sort of the same principle. It's not using the power, it's sucking it out of him in a way.
Well, I mean, you could even take it.
So we just evaporate or fall apart around it, you know, I don't know.
Well, the ability that the Golem has to change its form, you could even, again, associate that to the powers in Celebrandia that allow you to, in essence, change your reality at any moment. And so, again, there could be some connection there.
Yeah, or you could attribute it to just not necessarily saying, no, Matt, you're wrong, but just another idea is that you could attribute it to the one power or the true power that we assume Agenor made him with, but I do have to wonder what connections there may be between the Foxhead Medallion and other power negation fields that we know about, like the Guardian of Farmadin and
the Steady.
I mean, we know that the Guardian only protects against the true source, or the one power. Rand points that out in Towers of Midnight, but I have to wonder if the Steady, if one can channel the one power in the, or not the one power, but the true power in the Steady.
Good question. I think you should throw that one in.
Yeah.
Probably answer.
Ooh.
Yep.
I have my tweet deck open. Here we go. Let's see. Compose. From Fourth Age at Brandon Sanderson. Because it's not actually Sanderson. Sanderson.
Yeah.
Which I discovered, much to my chagrin recently. I was like, oh, well, that makes lots more sense now. So,
too many letters in your name. Sorry.
True power be channeled.
Actually, I should look this up before you. I wonder if
it's spelled channeled.
I should look it up. See if we would know what
to
quote.
In a setting. Yeah, that's true. We should try and look it up.
I'll look it up real quick. I'll let you know. Hold on one second. Oh no! Yeah, don't ask him. It's been answered.
Oh, goody. Which,
it was answered in 2005. Neither the one power nor the true power work in that setting.
Okay.
I hadn't read that in a very long time, so.
Yeah, that's in the, that's in Teresa's interview, what is it, interview database?
Yeah.
But can you enter Telerunriad from the setting?
Ooh.
Can a dreamer enter Telerunriad?
No,
yeah, why not?
Obviously it's different.
The setting does not have a reflection in Telerunriad.
There's that question. Is it a bubble and you can't enter it once you get to Telerunriad, or does it not exist? And is it kind of a, you know?
Yeah.
Is it a reflection? But it's not, you can't enter it, or does it not exist? I thought there was a question that connected what was seen about around Ruidian and the setting, that the effect was similar.
Yeah, it's this gray mist. You can't get in.
You couldn't get in, but obviously Telerunriad did exist in Ruidian. It's just you couldn't enter it. So, yeah, to me, it's an open question that maybe ask that one. You know, can a dreamer, dream themselves into Telerunriad if they fall asleep in a setting?
Well, I think the question there is, do they have to enter Telerunriad in the same physical location that their body's at? Which I don't think we've seen has to happen.
Yeah, I don't see any reason why you should. In fact, I think Egwene is very dismissive of the Aes Sedai because they can't get past that. They have to enter Telerunriad in their bedrooms and then walk to where the meeting place is.
Yeah.
Just makes her crazy.
Right. Yeah, they start out walking outside of Salador.
Well, yeah, doesn't she make her way out of her dream and into the Goy and then into Telerunriad? Or I thought she comes out of her dream once and then goes into Telerunriad. So obviously you can dream, and even being in a setting, I'm assuming you have a dream bubble in the Goy. And so obviously it would seem like she could get into the Gap of Infinity at the very least while in a setting. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question. You know, could she then move herself into... that's probably not very relevant, but it's fun to kind of put out.
It's interesting though.
There was another topic that came up in Towers of Midnight that related to Teleronrad, which is the nightmare concept, which is, you know, which Perrin is taught about and then uses pretty effectively. I can't tell if this is answered in the book. I don't get the feeling like every single nightmare ever is in Teleronrad, or is it only some nightmares end up there? I can't remember if it's answered or if it's ever specified that.
Maybe it's just nightmares that you're experiencing when you accidentally touch Teleronrad.
Okay, so yeah, so it's like a, it's not like a nightmare kind of automatically ends up there, but it's.
No, yeah.
Well, if it was every nightmare.
There would be a lot more people there.
Yeah, and if it was every nightmare ever, more people having nightmares die? And I think there would probably be a lot more nightmares too.
If they were dying in the mirror.
I thought it, well, the reason why I asked that is, I think Hopper says something like, where there's men, there's nightmares, you know. But obviously it doesn't mean every nightmare, but, he said there's always nightmares or something like that. So that was the question to me. It seemed like they were very easy to find. I didn't get the picture that normal dreams were like that, if that made sense. I didn't get the picture I got the picture that there were more nightmares that ended up in Teleronrad than just kind of the average dream.
Yeah, you know, the average person dreaming, yeah, probably.
Which I don't know if that's just because the nightmare is more visceral and so you're somehow more attracted to this real dreaming world other than just the normal dream. That's the impression I got. I don't know that that's the impression everyone had or if that's true, but I had the impression that there were more nightmares showing up than there were just kind of the average person popping into Teleronrad.
Yeah, it kind of seemed that way.
Well, the nightmare day, even after you leave, so they could just be hanging around there for a while and just accumulate over time.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And wasn't he able to destroy the dream spike in the nightmare? Isn't that how he did it or something like that?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he threw it into a pit of lava.
Right. Which I thought was interesting was the dream spike brought into Teleronrad at some point, I'm assuming by, I don't know if Ishmael found it there or I'm assuming he brought it in with him. So it was kind of that mix, the thing we've heard where Jordan talked about, I think someone asked if you could get rid of the oath while in Teleronrad and then Jordan changed the answer. I mean, he answered that you could bring a Teleronrad with you into Teleronrad, and it would remain there until you took it out.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting that a nightmare could destroy it. Nightmare and Teleronrad could destroy this physical object, which again does suggest, maybe going back to that Balefire question, you know, Teleronrad, no matter if something's there physically or not, it seems to really have, if you know how to use it, it seems to have, you know, be able to dominate any other power that's there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Before we move too far from the nightmare topic, I just realized that we have a voicemail from Lord Leopold Chaffee, and I'm wondering, Andrew, can you play this? For those of you not following along in the chat, Andrew typed this in as from Lord Leopold Chaffee, which is one of his favorite characters, and we just got to give him an opportunity to do the voice, basically. That's our 100th episode.
Yes, this is Lord Leopold Chaffee, and I was wondering if it is possible for a dreamer to score a wicket googly within a nightmare if they are sleeping within a steading.
I don't know why. It just for some reason cricket came to mind when we were discussing whether it was possible to enter the dreaming while in a steading, and somehow that transferred into having a...
Crickets? You said crickets?
The concept of scoring a wicked googly is just ricocheting around my brain for the moment.
Well, so I guess then let's try to wrap it up. Does anybody have any final thoughts on the topic that they would like to share?
No, I think we covered everything. I kind of what you said, because unless Matt has something to say.
Well, I got through my list. That's why I sort of got quiet. I ran out of topics.
Yeah, no, I think the last thing I would say is we get a little bit of a picture of things we haven't ever seen before, which I continue to enjoy about the series. Just a little bit more information when we see Rand as reintegrated, you know, Rand with seemingly 400 years of memories from Lutheran. At the end, be able to dream, but take control of his dream, such a degree that he's able to find peace and, you know, he's able to, I'm assuming he warded them and then he had kind of a,
cognizance. He was an awareness that he had never had before in the dream, in his own dream little world bubble. And then we see something happen with Lanfear. It's undetermined if that was really, you know, Moradin's dream that he was mixing or someone, you know, you'd think with Luz Theron's memories that he could have protected himself from something purposeful coming his way, but maybe his attraction to Lanfear somehow attracted them to Lanfear's dream. Anyways, there's a lot of this book, like we've talked about, happens in Teleron Riad, and then at the very end we get this little snippet, you know, where it seems like Lanfear is being punished, but that seems maybe like it's a lie, you know, to manipulate Rand, but she's being...
I think she's up to something.
Yeah, right. It does seem like that's a very good possibility,
it's
but
Lanfear, she's up to something.
Well, of course, but I also see the possibility where we know that dream bubbles attract, that are attracted to each other, you know, in the case of Egwene and Gawain, or how do you say his name? I just said he's gone. It, you know, we know that they're attracted to each other, so it does open the possibility that he was attracted, now that he's become Luz Theron in essence, that he was attracted to Lanfear's dream bubble, and that was like a genuine mix of dreams for a moment there. Of course, the suggestion has to be that it was some manipulation on Lanfear's and Moradin's part, but it's just, it ends with that moment, and then we see a crack in the shield that is this new Rand, where, you know, he has all sorts of emotions go through him, that now we're starting to get, I don't know, it kind of sets it on edge for me with this mix of what happens in Teleron Riad there at the end. So I thought that was a nice way to kind of still raise that level of Teleron Riad playing certainly a role in the end of the book.
Yeah, I think it almost has to. There's just been too much building up to it. And now we have other characters, you know, involved in, I mean, what's next? Matt's going to be a dreamer?
Well, he might end up having to be. Yeah, but when you think about Teleron Riad, there I go again. Teleron Riad, you know, of all the magical devices, I use the word magic with quotations around it because I know if that I refer to anything in the Wheel of Time as magic, I'm going to get shot. But but kind of these devices in the story, it's been around the longest. I mean, sure, the One Power kind of we saw first from Moraine. After that, really, it's the One Power has obviously been there the longest, but it's Teleron Riad that's been there since book one. Even before Perrin becomes a wolf brother, which is one of the first things to happen to the three boys, even before Matt grabs the dagger, you know, they're being pulled into Teleron Riad by Ishamael. So it can't have been in the first books if it doesn't have a place in the final books.
Yeah, and that was nice to see. And I'll leave you with my last theory, somewhat related to Teleron Riad, is that all of the ripping that we see Moradin do, you know, to the pattern, I believe that what we're actually seeing is, my theory is that true power skimming.
Hmm.
That's my theory.
That's interesting.
And when he says he steps into the void outside the pattern, that the void he's talking about is the skimming space, but it's true power. But that's my final word.
Very interesting.
I'm wondering if we're going to see, now that Rand has become good Rand again, are we going to see him channel the true power again?
We don't know.
I doubt it.
I mean, how can our hero be channeling the actual essence of the Dark One? I mean, that's kind of scary. But then, you know, if some have theorized that he actually ends up merging with Moradin, well, then he's going to be merging the good with the bad right there.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't he suggest that he knew he had access? I mean, didn't he suggest when he was going to talk to the... when he went down to formatting and he said something like, you know, that, well, you can channel the One Power, and he's like, yeah, not the One... he says something like, not the One Power, but...
yeah, not the One Power, but...
mm-hmm. Yeah, the Guardian protects against the One Power only.
Yeah, and it's a threat, but, you know, obviously, maybe he gained some memories or some knowledge with his reintegration where the proposition of channeling the true power is not as devastating and frightening as it was when he was pre-integrated, you know, Rand. So, I don't know. Maybe we will.
Makes you wonder if he's going to have to use the dark power to feel the dark power.
Powerful.
Seems counterintuitive.
Well, I know a couple of you have to be going on and leaving us here, so I think it's about time to wrap this up. And I would really like to thank you, Matt, and you, Jennifer, for joining us. And, of course, Andrew, Carrie, Spencer, Daniel, thank you so much for making the effort to be here again. And we've made it to 100. I don't know if we're going to make it to 200 at the end of the series, but
congratulations.
I think we did pretty well doing this.
Yeah, that's a great milestone. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I think that's sort of like the fifth season in a television show, you know. It's like once you've made it there, you've arrived.
We can syndicate you now.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me, by the way. I really appreciate the invite.
Anytime. We always enjoy your company here, and same for you, Jennifer. And
certainly you should delete that previous one that we did about Teleron Riyadh once we, and it was interesting. I knew doing it that there was other information coming, so certainly you should get rid of that.
Oh, that's right. But you were one of the beta readers on Tower of Midnight, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
It's so hard to talk about the books when you beta read and the books haven't come out yet.
Yeah.
Because you have to be like, that's a good series.
Yeah,
we wouldn't know.
DragonCon has been really hard on me the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It was an interesting thing to get used to. I think I told Therese that I had to get used to arguing what my previous point was before I knew the information I had. I got pretty good at it too, which at Theoryland is not a very tough thing because we all the time argue things that we already believe are wrong. At least some of us. So the idea that I was going to argue something that I already disagreed with, you know, that wasn't a problem for me in reality.
It actually sounds mad vaguely Talmudic.
I'll make Luckford crazy on Dragomount by posting just ridiculous crazy things. And he's like, wait a second, is that a spoiler? I'm like, you just don't know. It could be.
It's sort of time travel-y and everything, sort of gives you a headache just thinking about it. That's got to be one of my very favorite science fiction fantasy quotes of all time is from Star Trek, Death and Janeway. She was talking about time travel, and she said, it just gives me a headache. Time travel. It gives me a headache. It's sort of like some of these convoluted discussions that we get into with Real and Teleron Real and everything. It's like, who knows? I can't even begin to fathom, you know, Robert Jordan, James Rigney's mind. He's so far above my level of thinking sometimes that I go, oh my God. I would have loved to have been able to really sit down and talk with him in depth about some of these concepts, but unfortunately, we'll have to wait till I migrate to the next plane of existence.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I can even do a tangent on a closing. I mean, how pathetic is that?
You can get wondering how long it would take somebody to mention that.
Okay. Well,
we only started our closing 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. It's so hard to say goodbye.
Well, you would be able to talk to Robert Jordan, but if you went to JordanCon, you could talk to Maria and Harriet and
We're doing a new thing at JordanCon this year called a coffee clatch. And it's something that other, literary based conventions have been doing for years. So it's not a new thing in general. It's a new thing for us. But anyways, we're going to set it up where you pre-register for events and you're in a room with 10 other people and some members of Team Jordan. I'm going to split them into two groups. And you get to just sit there with you and 10 other people and pick Team Jordan's brain and have a one-on-one conversation with them for an hour.
Yeah, but 90% of that involves Rappo.
not
if you learn. You have to just learn your way around Rappo. It's take time.
So, yeah, we're going to have stuff up on the website soon about how you can register for the coffee class in advance.
Cool.
Oh, fun. That sounds great.
Want to be there.
Yeah, me too. Just got to get some money.
Yeah.
I just need to find a cash gold coin somewhere. Anyway.
I should include this in the conversation, I guess. This is the last, I know I already said this. I was going to say this is my last thing a while back. But at a signing last night that I went to, around here with Brandon, I did ask him, we got into conversation of the Gap Infinity and some stuff out from the Eye of the World, and I asked him if, because I wanted to know if Lanphier was a dreamer, and the only thing he'd give me was that he said, I lend a lot of credence to the theory that at least one of the Forsaken is or was a dreamer. So, but take that for I did my best to break him down, like, come on, this is ridiculous. You can just tell us one is. You don't have to say lend credence to. But he wouldn't break from his, like his kind of mid, you know, medium Raffo there. No matter how much I kind of belittled the idea, I'm like, we already know this information. Just say it, you know.
I think he's learned to enjoy watching it squirm.
Oh yeah. 5 minutes.
Oh, undoubtedly.
I went from belligerent to begging or something, you know. But he stayed with it. I lend a lot of credence to the theory that at least one of the Forsaken is or was a dreamer.
Was a dreamer.
We should bring a bunch of magic cards to GordonCon and try to, you know, bribe Brandon for answers.
Yeah.
Be like, let's just come to prayer.
Yes.
Is that possible? He must have every magic.
I mean, you guys tried candy last time, and I think there was a nickel involved.
Is it possible still to bribe him with magic cards? I mean, doesn't he have every magic card in the known universe by now?
No, he gives them away by the barrel, too.
Well, there's someone at the New York signing brought custom-made magic cards a la Wheel of Time.
I saw the picture of that. It was pretty awesome.
So you know, that's the real way to bribe him.
There we go. We got to work on
that. Now that I've given you custom-made magic cards, is landing you're a dreamer.
There we go.
No. We got to do it the other way around. We have a huge question and answer period with Brandon, and we say at the beginning, for every question you answer with a not a rapho, mapho, or otherwise vague,
we'll put a card in this pile.
You get a card.
Yeah.
If you give us a rapho, a mapho, or a vague answer, we take a card back.
The only time that's a good idea is if you force the entire audience to ask nothing but plot-related questions. Because if you get magic cards for answering who's your favorite character, I would scream, I think.
that's simple to accomplish, Matt. We just fill the audience with Theorylanders.
Yeah. It could be like that Money Drop show where like he starts off with a big pile of magic cards, and as he answers questions, if he gets them wrong, we take them away.
Yeah.
So he'd have to bring his own magic cards.
For every twisty, I die.
Just look my way during any question and answer period. You know, if you happen to be in the room and someone asks one of those questions that he's answered 5,000 times,
yeah.
I'm like on the ground, like writhing in pain.
I think that we have to have a special card for every twisty Aes Sedai answer that he gives.
We tear a card in half.
Yeah.
You don't get the bag either.
We need something like Lapho or Sappho, where it's like this. It's been asked like 7 times, so you got to go look for it yourself or something.
I think we need a Wafo, which stands for We Already Found Out.
I think Lapho, and on the back of the card, it should have instructions on how to find the information. Like,
or a booth, but they'll often find out.
On interviews. Because.
Yes, like, or it should just have like Therese and her phone number or something.
No, I'm thinking of that. What is that show? The Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Is about that? We'll have to ask Brandon some questions, and he'll say, "God, do I get to use one of my calls?" You know.
Yeah, we'll call it the TAPO.
We should totally do this at a convention. The JordanCon schedule is too set in stone right now to put that in, but we should totally do that some year. This is an evil idea. I love it.
I'm having absolute brain fade. I think it might have been, who was I talking about doing Wheel of Time tarot cards with? Was it
me? That was me.
Is that you? I thought so. Yeah.
I'm a huge tarot enthusiast, and I think that there's a great. I actually talked to Harry about it. Harry about it at the New York signing. She was non-committal, but could be interested.
Yeah.
By the way, if you guys can't make
Empress, may she live forever. And
what's that?
If you can't make 2011, I think. I'm trying to convince all of Theoryland that if they can't make 2011, they show up for 2012, because I think that's going to be, if I read things right, the book will be out in, you know, seems like the March kind of time frame of 2012. 2012 JordanCon will probably be kind of a
I'm really trying amazing. Not to bet money on that, because there's just so many things that can affect whether or not that book gets out.
That's
spring
true.
Of 2012. I mean, that's the earliest we can expect it. But he's not even going to be done with his reread, but he's going to finish the reread in time for this year's JordanCon.
Right.
So he's not even going to start writing until April, and he's going to take his time. There's a lot of stuff to go to this book. So, you know, maybe it'll take him a year to write it, maybe not. I don't know.
Once again, I want to thank everybody for joining us for our 100th episode. It's been a lot of fun. We hope to keep this going as long as we can. I don't make it, know if we'll make it to 200, but we'll give it our best shot. And for myself, this is Virginia saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
Hey, thanks guys for having me. It was great. It's a blast. And I will see you guys, you know, all over the place, but around Fairyland if you stop by.
Okay. Well, you know, you've got an open invitation anytime you want to come on. We enjoy having you.
Okay, and it was really great seeing everybody, or talking to everybody, I guess. And I'll see you guys in April at JordanCon, hopefully.
And from Daniel, may you travel from courage to strength.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyanento Manjima, Taishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
Honestly, I am still a little stoked that apparently at least Maria has listened to the podcast at some point in time. At least that way she's able to compliment Virginia on her research methods.
What am I missing?
What was I thinking? When we were going to set up the now probably postponed Maria and Alan's interview, Maria apparently had sent some comment in that was basically complimenting Virginia on, like, the thoroughness with which she goes through and, you know, remembers some of the little details that come out within the particular texts. It was just another nod toward Virginia being a Brown. And it was honestly, for me, I thought it was really nice because it was like, wow, that's not just one of RJ's assistants listened to the podcast, but listened to it and found that we could be complimented for. So.